Well, if you would please open your Bibles to Matthew 23. But in Matthew 23, we're on question number 9 of this series of questions. And the question is, how were the scribes and Pharisees blind guides? What was wrong with their teachings concerning swearing? So we've got a two-part question. The first part we've already answered, but I told Richard we can't answer the second half of it without looking at the context, see what the first half is about. We know that in Matthew 23, it is from our study of the context, what day is this occurring on? Anyone remember in the last week of Jesus' life, what day are the events of Matthew 23? Tuesday. Yes, they're on Tuesday. If you would kind of connect those thoughts together, that Matthew 23 and a lot of this controversy, Matthew 22 and 23 are on that Tuesday. It'll help, I think, to build the sequence of events up to the time of his crucifixion, which you've heard on Friday. Now, in Matthew 23, you want to note and probably have noted in your mind that it is a scathing rebuke of the scribes and Pharisees. Time and time and time and time again, he refers to them as hypocrites and tells us what they did that made them hypocrites. And so we want to note that. So in question number 9, how were the scribes and Pharisees blind guides? Somebody tell me, what made them blind guides?
They were saying that the material things were more important than spiritual things, really, is what they're saying. They're saying the gold of the temple is more important than the temple.
Okay. So that seems to be their focus all the way around. And all of these scathing rebukes throughout this chapter, their appearance before men, and material thing, all of this was more important than the spiritual side of it. And yes, when we refer to somebody as a blind guide, what did Jesus say was the ultimate end of both? Both fall into the ditch. That's right. So if somebody's trying to lead you and they're blind, then that's not good for anybody. But that was the position that the scribes and Pharisees had placed themselves in. Now that butts right up against the question, what was wrong with their teaching concerning swearing? Let's read it, beginning in verse 16. He said, "Woe unto you, ye blind guides, that say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. Ye fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that hath sanctified the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gift that is upon it, he is a debtor." That's what they said. He said, "Ye blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifieth the gift? He therefore that sweareth by the altar sweareth by it and by all things thereon. And he that sweareth by the temple sweareth by it and by him that dwelleth therein. And he that sweareth by heaven sweareth by the throne of God and by him that sitteth thereon." Now, you see, the point of emphasis in their mind was, if I swear by what I consider to be lesser, then I'm really not obligated to commit to do it. Now, that's just crazy.
I read in one of the commentaries, and I don't know, it said it's a possibility that their reason was that because a lien could not be held or put on the temple or the altar, that the things that they could were then more valuable or more, you know.
Yeah. Something that could serve as a collateral. For a debt, yeah. And they weren't obligated to get. Yeah, I read that, and I think that's just ludicrous.
Right.
It's just crazy, because what would make the gold in the temple set apart as special? Well, it would be the temple itself. What would make the sacrifice on the altar all that special? Otherwise, it's just a lamb out here wandering around. Would it not be the altar itself? And so their perception is just wrong. And the perception that they had allowed them not to do what they said they would do, because they believed they hadn't sworn to something greater, they'd sworn to something. Well, that's just ludicrous. And our point, I think, is really made a lot earlier than this. Of course, Matthew 23 is at the last week of Jesus' life. But if you back up to the beginning of his preaching, to the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, let's turn to that and begin reading, if you would please, in verse 8. Matthew chapter 5, no, it's not verse 8 that I want. It's verse 35. Verse 33, we'll begin at verse 33 to get the context. In verse 33 of Matthew 5, Jesus said, "Again, ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but perform unto the Lord thine oaths." Now look at that. You've heard it said that you shouldn't forswear yourself, but do what you've taken an oath to do. All right, question, do you have to take an oath in order for your word to be good?
No.
Well, no. And his point is in verse 34, "But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by the heaven, for it is the throne of God, nor by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, for thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your speech be yea, yea, nay, nay, and whatsoever is more than these is of the evil one." Now, point being, you don't have to do something because you've sworn to do it. You've taken an oath to do it by the lesser or the greater in your consideration. Just do what you said you would do. Isn't that simple? Just simply do what you said you would do. Let your yea be yea, your nay be nay, you're done. You don't have to take an oath to do it.
It's interesting the way he finishes verse 37. He says, "Let your sin be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is evil." The marginal reference says, "Or from the evil one."
Yeah.
Anything beyond yes or no, if you swear to God, you're really calling upon the devil.
And essentially, yeah.
It says it's an evil.
Just do what you said.
If you have to call, God to testify that you're telling the truth, you're not really asking God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's not what this says.
Well, that's right. And of course, often when we read this passage, somebody says, "Well, what about what you do in a courtroom as a witness?" I don't know how many of us have ever had to do that. I haven't. I dare say none of us probably have had to do that. Richard says he has, but that's not what he's talking about in this passage. In a courtroom, you're affirming that what you say is true for the benefit of that audience, but not for the benefit of God. What you say, you aim to do it. Do what you say you'll do.
I'm unfamiliar with whatever the system was. Was there a system where people would make an oath in the temple, and had they invented something like that? What's this?
I don't know that I can cite a for instance for you, Carolyn, but the very fact that...
Of the one where they think about, cut the hair, not cut the hair, was it related to those things?
Or? I don't really think so. Cutting the hair or not cutting the hair, some of that had to do with the Nazarite vow. And, of course, the wisdom writer in Ecclesiastes 5 says it's better not to vow than it is to vow and not do. And I often use that when I'm talking about marriage and the vows that we make to each other in marriage. Well, it's best not to vow than it is to make a vow and not do it. But his point here is to point out the hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees, to think that, well, I don't really have to feel compelled to do this because I only swore by heaven. I didn't swear and use God's name. Okay? So what are you saying? I really have an out or a back door to get out of what I said I would do. That's the point. A loophole, yeah. And that's kind of the point that's being established here. I don't aim to do what I said I would do. So because I didn't swear by the greater, instead I swore by the lesser and my judgment, then that gives me an out. I don't really have to feel committed to do it. And that's why he called them hypocrites. You see, the point is you're obligated by your word. Do what you say you'll do. You don't have to take a vow in order for it to be compulsory upon you. You said you would. Can I not take that to the bank? And that's the point that's being made throughout essentially the Sermon on the Mount. And I think that perhaps our comments from simply verses 33 and following need to be set in the context of the Sermon on the Mount itself. If you'll note, for example, in verse 27, he said, "You have heard that it was said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already with her in his heart. And if thy right eye cause thee to stumble, pluck it out," and so forth. And then beginning in verse 38, he said, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, resist not him that is evil, but whosoever smiteth thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also." And then in verse 43, "You've heard that it was said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies and pray for them that persecute you." What I want you to see is that repeatedly in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is establishing conduct after conduct after conduct that needs to be reined in, premised upon them calling themselves righteous. And he said to them in verse 20, "For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, we've already discussed what was the purpose of the so-called righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. To be seen of men, yes. But what Jesus says in this passage is, whatever their standard is, that's not the standard of God. That's their standard. What they do to be seen of men. Now, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. All right, does that mean I can go right up to the very act and not commit the overt act and maintain my innocence? Well, no. Jesus said, "I want that stopped up here." You stop that in your thinking. Now, why? Because in Matthew 15, beginning in verse 18, Jesus gives a laundry list of various sins, and he said that every one of them begins in your heart. So if you don't want to commit adultery, then where do you stop that? You don't allow your mind to go there to start with, you see. And if you don't want to be guilty of telling a lie, then you don't have to remember all of the things you swore to and the things you didn't swear to. Just tell the truth. You see the point? And if you don't want to be guilty of mistreating your neighbor, then love even your enemies and those that persecute you. So it's not a matter of don't commit this overt act, but you control yourself even in the way that you think. Now the scribes and Pharisees, they lowered that standard. It's all right to think about anything. It's all right to go there in your mind, just as long as you don't commit the overt act. And that's why Jesus called them hypocrites time and time and time and time again. Because their heart was not right. Randy, you had your hand up a moment ago.
You pretty well covered it.
Okay. Well,
I was just going to say that this is one of the, Matthew 5 is one of the proof texts that we will be judged by the things we think.
Yes. Yes.
Not just the things we do.
Yes.
We say. We'll be judged by those as well. But the things we think, God knows what we're thinking.
Yes.
We will be judged by it.
And we've made this point a number of times. I want to return to Matthew 15. I mentioned it just momentarily ago, but if you'll notice in verse 18 of Matthew 15, context, 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 of course, we know that the scribes and the Pharisees, they're critical of Jesus and of particularly his disciples because they have eaten without washing their hands. Now, that's just terrible to them. But who made it the law that you need to wash your hands before you eat? They did. You see, God had made it a law that you're to honor your father and mother. And they had lowered the standard on that. They said that whatever mother and father might have been profited by me in, I'll put that into the temple treasury. Well, what about mom and dad? You see, I think that what I've done is more noble than what God said. But in doing what I think is more noble than what God said, I've ignored what God said. And so Jesus called them hypocrites. And if you'll note in verse 7, he said, "Well did Isaiah," this is Matthew 15, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, this people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as their doctrines the precepts of men." Now, when Jesus rebuked them and called them hypocrites again. We note that the disciples came to him afterward and said in verse 12, "Knowest thou that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?" Well, what do you think? You think they were offended? Would you be offended if somebody just point blank called you a hypocrite and illustrated it for you? It's what you're doing. Well, the disciples said, you know, they didn't like that. All right, well, that's the way it is. He answered and said, "Every plant which my heavenly Father planted not shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They're blind guides." See it in verse 15 again. They are blind guides. "And if the blind guide the blind, both shall fall into the pit." Now drop down to verse 18, where Jesus has already pointed out that it's not something that you eat that defiles the body. So if you eat with dirty hands, you're not going to die. Like my dad used to say, it takes a bushel of dirt to kill a man. You're not going to die. If you eat with dirty hands, that's not going to kill you. Because it's not what goes in here that destroys a man. It's what comes out that destroys the man. You see, if you eat a little bit of dirt, Jesus' point and language is that it just passes through. It's not going to kill you. But what comes out of your heart will. It'll destroy you. And that's what he said in verse 18. He said, "But the things which proceed out of the mouth come forth out of the heart, and they defile the man." Verse 19, "For out of the heart come forth evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, railings. These are the things which defile the man, but to eat with unwashing hands defileth not the man." Now, isn't that simple? Eating with your hands a little dirty is not going to kill you. But you let your heart get dirty and you're going to do all kinds of ugly things. And that'll destroy you. Now, that's where the Pharisees were. And that's why Jesus now, toward the end of his ministry in Matthew 23, repeatedly rebukes them for their evil hearts now manifest in their practice and calls them a hypocrite. Now, most of you are aware of what the word hypocrite means. And perhaps we've discussed in some class, times gone by, the somewhat etymology of the word itself, hypocrite. What does the word hypocrite mean?
I remember it's referring to the ancient Greek dramas where they would wear a mask. For example, if women weren't actors, and so young men would play women's parts, and the mask indicated what character they were portraying, even though it wasn't really who they were.
All right, that's right. So the word hypocrite simply amounts to somebody that's pretending. They're not real. They're pretending. They're playing a part. We put that in quotation. And that's what that was. So the scribes and the Pharisees, they wanted to appear to be very righteous. But they weren't. On the inside, they were just as dirty as could be. And that's the point that is being established in our text. So I forgot where I was going with that, Linda, and your estimation of your comment about something being held for... lost my word.
Collateral.
Thank you. Being held for collateral. Of course, some of these greater things that we can't hold God as collateral, but you can hold the temple, okay? You can't hold the altar, but you can hold the lamb as collateral. And so, because we swear by something that can't be held as collateral, then maybe it's okay to not fulfill my word if I swear by that.
Where it mentions blind guides, specific
blind guides. Okay.
And at least in the ESV, it's only mentioned three times. So it's that Matthew 15:14, "Let them alone, they are blind guides, and if the blind is blind, will fall into the pit," which is in the context of the Pharisees insisting on the hand washing, whilst not worrying about the contributions to your parents. If they're ignoring something big in favor of something small. The second one is this one, where if anybody swears by the temple, it's nothing but the gold of the temple. They're focusing on something small instead of something big. And then the next one is in verse 24 of chapter 23, where he calls them blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow the camel, and that's about tithing the mint and the dill and the cumin and neglecting the weightier matters. So every time that Jesus calls them blind guides, it's because they're so nearsighted that they're not seeing any of the bigger picture. They're not seeing where their particular laws are falling into a grander scheme, to where God painted this to be a full spectrum of justice and mercy and faith. And you're focusing on the spices. Not that you should ignore them, but you need to expand your field of vision.
Yes.
So I'm not sure that blind is necessarily exactly the word, but they're at least very nearsighted.
Yeah. Can't see the forest for the trees. Yeah. Yeah, and we fall into that trap sometimes. Our focus on some of the smaller things so much so that we ignore the bigger picture. And that's a fallacy. All right. Any other comments or questions? Randy?
Just a verse that's related to this. In John 9, when Jesus healed a blind man, and as that's summarizing at the end of a chapter in John 9, verse 39, Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. Since you say we see, your sin remains."
So how do you answer the question? Yea or nay? Are we blind?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes. Yeah.
What made them sinners was that they claimed to see.
Yeah.
He claimed to be able to see.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a blind guy. Somebody who claims to see, but they can't.
Yeah. 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 And we don't want to fall into that trap.
We don't want to follow.
Yeah. Now, when we talk about somebody claiming to be able to see, or somebody claiming to be knowledgeable, somebody claiming to know, and the reality is they don't, we assign a word to that. Arrogance. Jesus used the word hypocrisy. They kind of go together.
Along those same lines, there is a section in Romans 2, starting in verse 17, in terms of the arrogance and the hypocrisy and the blind guides.
Yeah.
It says, "But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know his will and approve what is excellent because you are instructed from the law, and if you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you."
Yes. And that man, right on target. Good job. Just good job. The context of Romans 1, 2, and 3 is just fascinating to me, because in Romans 1 we see a description of the practices of the Gentiles. They had abandoned the knowledge of God and they're doing everything they want to do or would desire to do. But in chapter 2 you've got the identification of the Jew who points his finger at Mr. Gentile and says, "Shame on you. Look at what you're doing. You're doing all these terrible things." And then you get to the text that you were discussing in chapter 2 where Paul points his finger at Mr. Jew and said, "You condemn the Gentile, but you're doing the same thing. You're doing exactly the same thing." So how do you reconcile that? There's your hypocrisy. Blind guides. Good. Really good job. So that's very fitting with our study. Any other comments or questions? Well, Jenny has brought up something that kind of leads us into the next question that we want to consider. Were the scribes and Pharisees condemned for tithing mint and anise and cumin? Well, the obvious answer to that is no. No, they weren't condemned for tithing of these things. But the problem was they were so focused on those small things that they ignored the larger things. And that's to miss completely the point. Let's look at the text, if you would please. Beginning in verse Matthew 22. Well, before we're here, let's read this text. In verse 23, it is. Verse 23, Matthew 23:23. I'll say it in a minute. He said, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye tithe mint and anise and cummin, and have left undone the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. But these you ought to have done, and not to have left the other undone. Ye blind guides that strain out the gnat and swallow the camel." This is not the first time Jesus has addressed this. If you'll turn back again, as Jesus had come into the city of Jerusalem, to Matthew 20, where is it that I want to be? Oh, I'm trying to find it in my notes. Matthew 22, here it is. Matthew 22, look with me if you would please in verse 40. Matthew 22, verse 40. We'll begin with the question of this certain lawyer or scribe, as Mark's account gives it in Mark chapter 12 and verse 28, ask for the intent of trying Jesus. Matthew 22 is where I am in verse 35. "And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, trying him, 'Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?' And he said unto him, 'Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is likened to this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself.'" Now notice verse 40. "On these two commandments, the whole law hangeth, and the prophets." Now Jesus is quoting from some Old Testament text from Deuteronomy and Leviticus, but he says, on these two things, loving God and loving your neighbor, hangs the whole law and the prophets. Now elaborate. How is that so? On these two things, loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. The whole law hangs on that. How come? If you got those two things down pat, you've got the application consistent, you've got the rest of it. How come, Randy?
I don't know. I can't answer that. How come?
Ah.
I was just going to point out that the Ten Commandments, first four had to do with our relationship to God. The rest of them had to do with our relationship to each other.
Yeah.
So that's
the how come.
In that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you love God and all that goes with it, then you're going to put Him first. And if you love your neighbor, you're going to treat them right as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the law is the details of it.
That's right. When you go back to the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Leviticus, when we talk about the priesthood, they're all related under those things. So, correct, on these two hangs everything else. You get these two right, and you've got it. Now, let's go take this principle back to what they were doing and what they're rebuked for concerning the their tithing of the mint and anise and cumin. Jesus is pointing out, now, I don't know if any of you have herb gardens or not, or are familiar with just how small these things are. But the point is that these things were indeed regulated by the law of Moses. They were to give 10% of everything that they had. And so that would include some of these smaller things. But to give such detailed attention to these smaller things and to neglect the weightier matters, as he discusses justice and mercy and faith, what does that mean? You don't have to tithe of the mint coming and the third one was what? I just lost it. Anise, thank you. Yeah. Does that mean you don't have to tithe of these things? Well, no. That was regulated by the law as well. But that doesn't give you the privilege then, because you're so careful to divide up into portion even these tiny little things, to neglect the weightier matters of the law. Well, you can't do that. Because what was the consequence? For example, we used this illustration earlier from Matthew 15. If you neglected father or mother, now what? Let him die the death. Okay, well, you can't do that and opt for taking that wherewith mother and dad might have been benefited, so I'll put it in the treasury. All right. You can't ignore the laws of God no matter what they are. To create your own or to try to be consistent with the smaller things and neglect the larger things. You can't do that. Consistency demands you do what God said. No more, no less. Isn't that simple? Well, having said that, let's talk just a little bit about tithing. Tithing of mint, cumin, and anise. That was a part of it, wasn't it? But so was tithing of, that is, giving of 10% of anything that you had. Your flocks, your herds, your grain, whatever it was, you gave 10% of it. Now, are we under obligation to tithe? Well, why not?
Not under the law.
We're not under that Old Testament law. Now, that's important for us to see that. That the law of Moses commanded the Israelites to give a tenth of their produce, their livestock, everything that they had. It was to be offered in sacrifice and used to support the priests and the Levites. Now, if you want some passages on that, we'll throw out Leviticus 27 and Deuteronomy 12 to illustrate the point. And the use of it, we can see not only in the book of Numbers, but we can also see it in the book of Nehemiah. You remember when they were returned to the land after the period of captivity, and the quarters of the priests and so forth that were to be in the temple had now been inhabited by the enemies of the Israelites. And so where were the priests? They were out in the field working for their sustenance, because they couldn't count on the tithe. The people weren't doing that. And when Nehemiah came back, what did he do? He rebuked them harshly and set that in order and cleaned out the temple and the places that the priests and the Levites were supposed to be living, and set back in order the storehouses that were to contain the food, the produce, and whatnot that the priests were to be supported with. You remember that? Leviticus chapter 8, 9, all in through there, maybe 7. So that was the context that we see in that instance. Question? What did I say? No, Nehemiah. It's still in Nehemiah. Chapter 7, 8, 9, I believe it is. I think it's perhaps 9, I think.
It's not in Leviticus.
It's not in Leviticus. No. Case in point. It's not in Leviticus. So the priests didn't have what they needed because the people weren't giving as they were supposed to be giving. And they'd inhabited and brought in the enemies into the priest's quarters and so forth. That's Nehemiah. So our point is, they were to tithe of mint, anise, and cumin. But they were to take care of these other things as well that they had been neglecting. And of course that made them hypocrites in the nth degree. Any comments or questions?
Just the contrast between something so small and something so big as justice, mercy, and faith.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are giant things that they were neglecting.
Yeah, well, see, that gets us to this next question. Jesus had addressed this, as we commented on Matthew 22 earlier. In fact, earlier in this week, or this series of events of coming into the city of Jerusalem. Now you recall that neglecting justice, mercy, and these so-called weightier matters of the law, how do you do that? Justice, mercy, and faith. Fundamental. Just fundamental. How do you neglect these things? There's an Old Testament text, and in fact, you've probably heard me preach on it. I know you've heard Chris preach on it when he was here. From Micah chapter 6, what doth the Lord require of thee? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And that puts it pretty simple, doesn't it? I don't know that you can find a better commentary on this text with the emphasis placed upon these weightier matters that are identified in this context. Any comments or questions? Yes, Randy?
Well, in recent memory, the way they treated John the Baptist, there was no justice, there was no mercy.
No,
They clearly had no faith.
No.
And what they're about to do to Jesus within the next few days.
Yeah.
No justice, no mercy.
Yeah. And their minds have already charted the course to that end in this text when this is happening.
Been looking for a time to kill him.
Yeah, been looking for a time to kill him for some time. Yeah, so that's exactly right. So, yes?
It seems like they had taken the law and they had boiled it down to a checklist.
Yeah.
So you have this list. These are the things that I need to do, and I can check them off one by one by one by one by one by one. And once I'm done, then I'm done. And once you've done that, you've taken all the joy out of it.
Or you cut the heart out of it.
You took the reason behind all of these actions out.
Yeah.
And so it makes for mindless obedience.
Yeah.
And you have this list of things that you're getting done, and you don't know why you're doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
The letter of the law.
Yeah, and you know, we can be called Pharisees by some. In fact, some in times, recent times, have called members of the Church of Christ Pharisees because you're so strict you want to go by the book. Well, you know, keep this statement in mind regarding their hypocrisy because they were so careful about the men Annas and Cummins. But does that mean they ought not be careful about the men Annas and Cummins?
So they were just talking about going by the book. They're only going by half of the book.
Yeah.
So the book defined all this.
Oh, yeah.
They were just deciding which one they wanted to use.
Yeah, cherry-picking what they wanted to do, yeah, and condemn the rest. And that's what they were doing. We don't want to be like the Pharisees. The heart has to be involved. Now, I mentioned a while ago, and I didn't go quite as far as I intended to, on question number 10 about the tithing. We noted that is an Old Testament practice. That's really important for us to understand that. That's an Old Testament practice. It required a tenth of everything they had. They had to be conscious of that and set aside a tenth of everything. Their grain, their crops, their everything, their cattle. God has not required that of you or me. But what he has required is that we lay by in store upon the first day of the week as we have been prospered. Now, the amount is not stated. The amount is not stated. And it's a little distressing to me sometimes when I hear folks who ought to know better, folks who've been members of the church for 30 years, and they refer to their contribution upon the first day of the week as the giving of their tithes. It's not a tithe. Tithing was strictly an Old Testament practice. We're not under the Old Testament. That was nailed to the cross. Ephesians 2, as many of you have learned, 14 through 16, and Colossians 2, 14 through 16. Also, the whole book of Hebrews identifies that. But when we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, the apostle's much concerned about the needy brethren, the needy saints in the city of Jerusalem, the needy Christians in Jerusalem. He says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I gave order to the churches of Galatia, so also do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let each one of you lay by him in store, as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomsoever ye shall approve, them will I send with letters to carry your bounty unto Jerusalem. And if it be meet for me to go also, they shall go with me. Now look at that carefully. How were they to give? A tenth of everything they had? Well, that's not what it says. It says to lay by in store as you've been prospered. Now what amount is that? Does God dictate a tenth? No. But he does tell us in this passage that there is a proportion between how much I have as income and how much then I contribute. Keeping that in mind, as the apostle has written that in the instructions of 1 Corinthians, just a little bit later, we find that he's writing a second letter to the church in Corinth, and he revisits this. He's on his way. Keep that in mind from 1 Corinthians 16. When I come, those that you appoint, they can go with me. You see, he's on his way. But in the 2 Corinthian letter, he's just not far from there. He's up in Macedonia traveling toward Corinth, which is in Achaia. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he says, moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God which hath been given in the churches of Macedonia, how that in much proof of affliction, the abundance of their joy and the deep their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For according to their power, I bear witness, yea, and beyond their power, they gave of their own accord, beseeching us with much entreaty in regard of this grace and the fellowship and the ministering to the saints. And this, not as we had hoped, but first they gave their own selves to the Lord and to us through the will of God. Note that Paul is commending those of Macedonia as he's traveling on his way to Corinth to pick up their collection to take it on to Jerusalem. And he says somewhat more to those in Corinth in this second epistle. In the 9th chapter, beginning in verse 6, he said, "But this I say, he that soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he that soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Let each man do according as he hath purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." Now, in all of this reading, do you find anything where God told them, give 10%?
I view 1 Corinthians 16 there as an extra offering.
As what?
An extra offering for other saints that are in Jerusalem.
Well, it was.
Rather than their own tithes or offerings.
Well, let's back up. What they did in 1 Corinthians 16 is not tithing, because tithing is not commanded in the New Testament. It was in the Old. What we see in 1 Corinthians 16 really is the only collection that we read about in the New Testament that's done with any regular basis. They gave upon the first day of the week. That's all I know. I'm sorry?
Extra?
No, I don't think it was extra, because keep in mind that those in Corinth, they were not Jews. They were not under the law of Moses. So they never had been under the law of Moses, which required giving a tenth of everything.
But it seems to the set apart of the finances for the church.
That's what they were doing. That's what they were participating in. I'm not sure I heard all of what you said. Say that again just a little bit louder.
In the Old Testament, tithing is mandatory if you are a member of the church. It's 10% of whatever you have in your earnings, right?
That was a part of being a Jew. You had to give 10% of everything that you had. But it's not a part of the church. That's strictly an Old Testament practice. Now, this was for the needy saints in Jerusalem, Christians who were destitute of food and clothing. One more time. Yeah, this 1 Corinthians 16 was an offering that was made to the church. Yeah, so that the church could do its work. And tithing.
The church needed it.
I'm sorry?
The church needed it.
It needed it, yeah.
That's why it says, yep. Can you give it a special offer?
Yeah.
For this cause, for the church's cause, but for a person that is in need,
yeah.
Or a family that is in need.
That's right. That's what it was to be used for. Now, does that mean that's all it could be used for? That's a good question. Because what we read in other passages, for example, 1 Corinthians 9, 14 and following, and some passages found in Philippians 11, chapter 4, we know that it was used to support preachers. The Apostle Paul, for example. It was used also for the building up of those who are Christians. So we have teaching material, Bibles. Yep. But where did the funds come from? This first day of the week collection.
Well, we don't have all of it.
I'm sorry?
It's so we won't go for
most of it. Right. So that those who are saints that don't have the necessity, they can have it. Yeah, that's exactly right.
We need to want to pay for something
that to do. Yeah. It can be used for that.
Yeah.
For a place to worship. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. But this is the source. This is where it comes from. 1 Corinthians 16. I'm sorry I'm having difficulty hearing that blower back in the back. I meant to close those doors. I just can't hear that blower back there. But I think that's the point. Yes, here's the source of the resource that the church has by these contributions on the first day of the week. And that's important. It's very important. You're very welcome. Good comment. Good question.
You know, say that the thrust of Paul's writing to the church in Corinth as he's going back down there to them for the collection, he mentions that the purpose is not to hurt you and benefit other people, but it's to make sure that there's equality.
Yeah.
So that if you're doing well, then you can give to those that are not doing so well. And that's the purpose that we have the treasury, as it were, that we have funds laid up so that we can say, oh, well, we understand that the saints down here aren't doing well, and I think we need to help them. For the same reason that if something happens to us, that those other saints somewhere else who are doing well can help us.
That's right.
He says, so that there may be equality.
Yeah, and that idea of equality is something that probably needs just a little bit of comment. There is an Old Testament illustration that's cited in 1 Corinthians 8 and 9. And that is back in the book of Exodus when they were coming up out of the land of Egypt. The children of Israel were crying to Moses, what are we going to eat? What are we going to eat? And God gave them manna to eat. Now, the thing was, they needed to learn that the source of their food was God. And so they were told to go out and pick up an omer. You can do your own research about how much that was. I don't know. But pick up an omer of manna, one omer, per person in your family. So if you had a family of 12, you'd pick up 12 omers of manna for your family for that day. Yeah, per day. Now, if you had a family of 4, you'd go pick up 4 omers of manna per day. Except on Friday, you'd pick up 2 because you weren't to work on the Sabbath day. All right. Now, the point being established in the book of Exodus and, of course, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 is that those who had need would have their needs supplied. They wouldn't have any lack, but they wouldn't have anything over. Now, some tried to cut corners in the Old Testament on that. They thought that they would go out and pick up maybe 2 or 3 omers per person per day, and what happened to it? It spoiled. Worms got in it. Okay, it was spoiled. Now, why wouldn't it spoil on Friday when they went out and picked up enough for Friday and Saturday?
God
said to do that, you see. But if they tried to cut the corner and disobey God, then it would spoil. But the point of the illustration is from this going out and picking up an omer per person per day was so you wouldn't have anything extra. But nobody would go hungry. There wouldn't be any lack. And so that's God's provision for his own. All right, we're out of time. Any other comments or questions? Randy?
I don't want to get you started on something new. As you've said many times, God expects the pattern that he gave us. The pattern that he gave us for raising funds for the church is found in 1 Corinthians 16.
Yeah.
Which is on the first
page. Yeah. There's pattern. Yeah. 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, I like to include those with 1 Corinthians 16 because it revisits the issue he's already addressed and provides for us considerably more information on it. He makes a point, however, that perhaps we need to underscore in 2 Corinthians 8, 11, and 12. He said, but now complete is the doing, or complete the doing also, that as there was the readiness to will, so there may be the completion also out of your ability. For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according as a man hath, not according as he hath not. Now, that's an important principle. So if everybody gives as they have prospered,
then you're going to have some over here going to be giving a little more. You're going to have some over here that's not been, going to be giving as much, but there's not going to be want. Okay. Thank you for comments and questions.
Always. We don't take contributions every day of the week.
Pardon me?
And we don't take contributions.
No, not every day of the week, because the Lord didn't authorize every day of the week. Yeah.